Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Adam Barrett. And we are interested in talking about something that I think kind of grinds our gears sometimes, which is specs and how constraining they can be and get out of date and end up doing more harm than good.
I wouldn't say specifications. I'd say standards.
Standards.
Industry standards. Yeah, industry standards kinds of stuff and military standards. And, you know, specifications is our engineering attempt to measure something that we think the customers want. So that's how I'll define that.
But standards are specifications over time. That's true.
No, I don't know. Well, there's different kinds of, there's all kinds of standards, but
I agree with you that we're talking about specifications. I agree.
Or standards.
Standards. I agree with you. We're talking about standards. Jeez, I can't agree with you. I'm trying to, and I just can't will to agree with you.
Yeah. Well, I'll work with you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Good thing you're 3,000 miles away.
Right.
One of the issues I run into with standards is somebody will use a industry standard, and it could be IEC, it could be ISO, it could be ASTM, it could be a measurement standard, it could be a whatever. But in the reliability world, there's a range of different bodies that put out like a temperature standard. You're going to test your product for its ability to withstand a temperature. And it says run it to 40 degrees C or 85 C and so much humidity for a certain amount of time and use 3 samples or 5 samples. And it gives you very specific details. Do this, and then you've passed the standard. But that's all it does. It doesn't say what it means. I've rarely run into a standard that actually helps you interpret. Is this the right thing to do? Is this meaningful for my product and application? And when I get results, what does that actually translate to or mean? Right. And so those are the kind of the things that grind my gears around standards.
Right.
One of many. So this might turn into a rant, actually.
Well, exactly. This one definitely has the earmarks for that. Right. So that's the whole thing is what was the intent of the standard originally? Because all those questions you're asked were what drove it, right? And then that they were no longer connected to it like in a documentation kind of form because it became something that people just wanted to pass or fail. So it kind of didn't matter where it came from or what it really meant because it was forced upon. Somebody had to pass it. But right. So the double-edged sword is that it creates consistency and locks, you know, something down so that you can compare, right? You can compare two different things that are removed from each other by time or space and say, yes, they both passed this or this one did and this one didn't.
Well, I think part of standards in general at a very high level is to create a document or a vehicle for articulating exactly what you want done, and you can put it in a contract. You know, thou shalt pass standard XYZ to this clause, and then you don't have to rewrite all of that stuff out. You know, do mill standard 810 clause 5A and 6B, and that's all you got to put in the contract. And it's very clear what the procedure is, the conditions, what a pass-fail is. All of those things are, although not technically all that clear in my opinion, but it's for making a common language for contracts, but also just a common language for us to do, like you said, Adam, the comparison. So those are actually not bad things to have.
No, but that's why I said double-edged sword. So then the other side is now that you've locked it in, which is fantastic for creating consistency, is you've locked it in. And now it's not flexible to changes.
That's right. Can you imagine Boeing coming into the market with their composite wings, right? And going to the FAA and saying, you know, the standard that we've been using for 50, 60 years, thinking of our last episode about this old airplane, has been on aluminum wings. And so the criteria for judging the two completely different material sets. Is it the same because the forces and stresses we're going to see are the same, or is it different because it has a really different failure mechanism? It behaves differently under those loads. So is the same standard adequate or reasonable or meaningful? You see this all the time when materials change. People go to a different material set completely, and the only standard that's out there was developed for, one, two, three generations of material before.
And right.
So
right.
It's just, that's where I have a problem with the static part of the standards, is that it doesn't include a prelude that says, this standard is for these circumstances.
Right. And it can entirely backfire if not carefully evaluated. Your example with the airplane wing, with aluminum and carbon fiber, with aluminum, you can have very small cracks, and as long as they're not changing or moving, you're fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, with carbon fiber, if you scratch it, you could potentially have catastrophic failure instantly. So you'd right. So
now
if
it's
you
even were harder to get on an airplane. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. I have a funny story about a friend of mine. We're doing a bike race. It was 500 miles, and he thought it was going to be cool. This is back in the 90s, mm-hmm. and he got a bike with carbon fiber spokes. So just like, it looked like metal spokes. So it's a very thin, wire-like, but they were carbon fiber, and he thought that was going to be awesome or whatever.
Very light.
We're doing 500 miles. We're doing 100 miles a day. We're camping at night.
Right.
And these aren't like a racetrack. This is roads out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So every time he hit a bump or got even the slightest like overload, his whole wheel would undo like a zipper. I'm just talking like over the handlebars, crashing, because those were meant to take high tensile stress, but you can't have a nick or a scratch. And if you take shock loads, they don't give like aluminum. So if you get the slightest, fracture, the entire thing comes undone. And then all the other ones have no margin.
Mm-hmm.
So they just, the whole wheel comes off like a zipper. Like, and when I mean like picture a wheel with no spokes,
it was
so frustrating. I mean, I'm talking like a week of this. Like, it's
How many wheels did he have with him?
Well, no, he had to go. I ditched him after a while. Like, and I'd see him at night at the campground. I was like, forget you.
Yeah.
You're hot shot. You're bragging about your super new expensive bike. trust me, there were like this is in Iowa, and there were like, I think there was like 1,200 of us out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was lots of bike repairs and parts people and stuff like that and everything.
Right, right.
So, yeah. Anyway, so that again, that exactly. So whatever the specifications are, that would have had to be entirely different. Like like with the wing. And the funny thing is, it can have the opposite effect. One being a car guy that I always remember is it ended up going from being a specification to make things safer that it made it more dangerous. Before 1955, headlights in cars could be a separate bulb and then a back reflecting material,
right.
So the back reflecting glass. And what would happen is that back in the 1930s and 40s is the reflective material would wear off. So you just would have the bulb without the mirror behind it. So the headlights would get dimmer and dimmer over time.
Right.
So they made a standard that all beams had to be sealed beam, which mean that when you replace the head, the light bulb, you had to replace the back as well. So the filament and the back mirror were all one piece, which you probably remember if you've worked on any car.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way
those
they
light
were.
Bulbs, they just were big, chunky light bulbs, but
the filament
was small. Yeah.
Right. But you had a huge, the mirror part was with it. So that was a great standard because it forced the mirror part to always be fresh.
Don't tell me they had to do that with LEDs now, do they?
No. So here's the thing though. You locked in headlight technology to 1955.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world continued to make better and brighter headlights with better mirror shapes, better ways of angling the light, better filaments. And America was locked in until 1985, having to use seal beam headlights. So we basically were locked in the same headlight technology for 30 years to where by the time we came out of it, we were so far behind in bright. It was amazing what a change it was once we were allowed to adopt the headlight technologies from around the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the specification at that point, because it was ignored and just nobody reevaluated it, actually, ended up hurting the same cause it was trying to help.
Yeah, I don't think standards drive technology. I think there's some safety standards that I know California in particular is now looking at saying, no, you have to have these safety features in vehicles and so on in order to sell in our market, or gas savings, mileage standards.
That's
stuff.
Very good.
But those are regulatory, right? They're not they're on the edge of what I would consider the standards we tend to deal with. I'm thinking of my all-time favorite poster child standard is 85-85. It's 85C at 85RH for 100 hours or 1,000 hours or something like that. Okay. Now, Adam, you've done accelerated testing. What acceleration factor are you going to get with 85C?
Well, I'm highly suspect of any numbers that match that conveniently, 85 and 85.
Well, that was also possible to do in most standards. I mean, in most ovens and chambers and humidity chambers, they could actually achieve that. So it was
probably
a compromise.
Oh, I see. Okay. But no, that comes entirely down to the chemistry of the materials involved. It's the activation energy. It has, you know, with regard to what acceleration factor.
Which backs up that, is it even a chemical process? If it's not a corrosion, a chemical process, it's just mechanical fatigue or creep. Well, the temperature will affect that also. And it's not an Arrhenius equation. So it's kind of a trick question there for you, right? But you're right. Yeah. The standard doesn't say. It just says do this and you pass or fail the test. And it's like many, many standards. You can pass the standard and get this false sense of, oh, I passed all these standards. It must be good. When it goes out and they all fail in 3 weeks. Because it doesn't give you the information you really need to come back to it.
Is this a psychology we're really getting down to, that people like comfort and easy answers?
Is that
where this ends?
Well, that's where MTBF, why it's still around, but that I digress. But there's part of it is that it has those benefits, right? It's easy to put on language. The marketing guys love it. I list these exotic looking international standards and numbers and titles and pass, or meets these criteria and all that stuff. Unless somebody else on the other side knows how to interpret what those standards are, it's filler as far as I'm concerned, but it looks good. But you're right. I think there's a comfort in, well, that's what we're going to use standards because it helps us feel like we're using a standard that somebody else thought through, which is probably why they don't want to think. It might be part of the problem. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's a great way to check off that you've done reliability.
Yeah. Now, how about there are some standards, though, that are more stress-based, right? They say, well, if you're going to ship something in a vehicle, say UPS or a truck or something like that, there are standards that replicate simulate or add as a similar profile as if you were shipping something by truck or aircraft or whatever, but the standard is based around an actual profile of some environmental set of stresses. What do you think of those type of standards?
So yeah, the ISTA, those, I think they're great as long as we are still transporting things the same way, right? So I think that those are very helpful because that is from a very specific research case with a specific composite case that they've, you know, have, and that if you pass this, you should be able to handle 99% of shipping stresses. But that's making the assumption, of course, that you are shipping it the way that the standard was based on. So if our shipping technology changes dramatically, then you would have to update that.
You think they're already working on the instead of shipping by, what do they call it? Air cushion, 40-foot trailers, that they're going to use the exact same profile and standard for 3D printing? Because now I just send you the plans and you print it in your shop.
Right. My email's ISTA certified. Is that what you mean?
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly. But it might be different, right? Like, because think about, in all seriousness, right? Amazon's talking about having drones deliver stuff and they're going to drop them from a specific height. They're not going to, you know what I mean? Like that probably is going to be, that's obviously a very different delivery method than an 18-wheeler or ship or whatever. Like what are all the different things that can happen when you drop something by drone?
Yeah, I wonder how many standards for longshoremen transport, you know, where the longshoremen are still hauling their stuff off by hand up onto the beach.
right, exactly. Or the carriage bouncing down a dirt road and the horse kicks it. I don't know. Yeah, exactly. So it would be pretty interesting to see, which would probably be really hard to find what went into creating that standard.
Yeah. But usually it's, you know, six old men in the back of a hotel room trying to sort out a minimum common denominator they all can agree to.
Right. And nobody knows who they were. It was a mystery meeting.
Well, yeah, there's some standards that you get listed if you participate or work on. I think IEC, you get listed. I believe so. But there are other standards where it's anonymous and you don't get, so there's no credit or anybody, if you recognize somebody on the standard, you can ask them, what was the deal here? Right. Right. There's plenty of them that are, now some standards, like how do you measure hardness? Right. There is a technique. There is a lab reproducible process for measuring hardness, right? Depending on what kind of material you have. And those ASTM standards are more procedural based. If you do this, this, and this, and this with this equipment, you'll get a reproducible measurement. You know, it might still have measurement error in it. It's still got to be the appropriate type of measurement for your system. Yet those standards are actually, those, in my opinion, stand the test of time. The hard part is that when we come up with a completely better technology for making measurements, like temperature, right? It used to be stick a thermocouple on it. Now we've got thermistors and we've got, for surface stuff, the infrared measurement systems. And we get so much more information than what a very error-prone thermocouple can give you. Yet some of the ASTM standards require you to use a bimetal type measurement gauge or sensor to make it work if you follow it strictly.
And right.
Double-edged sword is the exact right term. But I wanted to go back to that sense of comfort and the lack of thinking through it, because the standards rarely include what are the boundaries of where this applies and where it doesn't apply. What material set is it intended for? What kind of application is it intended for? Like the vehicle ones based on stress. This is for this style of truck with these kinds of suspensions and on this quality of road.
But the problem is you also don't know, right? As somebody who's, you don't know what kind of truck your product's going to be on. So it's in a set, it's kind of essence that interesting, because that one is helping you make an estimation for something you don't know and you won't know. There's no way you could predict what kind of trucks you're going to be on. You need somebody to make an estimation for you. So that's the value of that.
It adds, it helps you get started. It gives you a place to get started on. But as you start shipping, if you have shipping related damages, well, then the standard's not serving you. You got to move beyond that. And the argument back to a customer that opens boxes of broken product is, well, it passed the shipping standard. Well, that doesn't get you anywhere with a customer. It's like, no, come on, figure it out. Where if you have no problems whatsoever with shipping and you got nothing else to work on, then go look at that and say, well, maybe we're over designing the packaging and we can cut some corners there and save some costs there. But there are appropriate ways to use standards. It's a starting point, but always, always, always ask, does this apply? What's the science here? Why does this make sense? Just stacking them up and running them through and hope you pass all the standards is not reliability work.
I guess it comes down to how much risk you're willing to take. Are you willing to, in the example you just gave, to use the standard, say it's okay, have it go, and then look to see if you are having any issues you can root cause back to shipping and then do an in-depth study. Mm-hmm. That's not an unacceptable strategy to say, hey, we're going to use the standard for now. And then if we do see something pointing at this, then we'll investigate it deeper as opposed to doing it up front.
Yeah. Well, I just saw yesterday, it was an article. It was by one of the tech magazines. It was a company that tests. It's sort of like Consumer Reports, but for electronics products specifically. And they took the new iPhones that came out recently and drop tested them. And the first one they picked up, I don't know which model it was, they picked up, and the first drop was at 6 feet onto the face, and it shattered. I was like, wow, they started that high. I was surprised by that. And I was like, oh, no wonder. It's all glass. I'm not surprised it failed. But they said it got a better score than previous models because the case and the way it's structured did better than previous models. It was cracked screens, but you could still use them. It was only shattered, you know, in certain angles. And It's like, and then they had a tumble test. You ever see one of those?
No.
So imagine take like your cell phone and a bunch of other stuff, just random stuff you would find in a briefcase or a purse, and throw it into a dryer.
Yeah.
And let it tumble. So it gets lots of very small falls. And they said it actually did pretty well in that. It got scuffed and marked and, you know, abraded and stuff. So part of the design process is fitting to what they know about previous ones and where they fail. And in a briefcase or they also did the bend test to make sure that it didn't flex. Was it the iPhone X or the one prior to that that people would sit on and it would bend over?
Right. I recall that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I always wonder with the iPhone, with the phones is so funny, is they always work so hard to make them so thin and light, and then we all have to buy cases to put on them. It seems like if you just designed in that robustness up front with a phone that was a little bit thicker, you know, it would probably still be less thick than the big cases we put on, but would be able to handle it. It's really funny that it's just a given that they're designing a product that they're advertising is so thin and wonderful, but we instantly assume we have to buy a design modification.
Yeah. The industrial design is everything. You know that.
I guess so.
Seen it. So, yeah. There was a whole Dilbert cartoon series about that where they designed something that was guaranteed to slip out of the customer's hands within seconds and crash.
Right. 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 Exactly.
That was their design. Make it as slippery as possible.
It's like buying a Ferrari and then wrapping it in pool noodles, you know, big foam pool noodles to keep it safe, you know. Doesn't make a lot of sense at the end of the day.
Yeah, would that help?
The big foam poon noodles? Well, I mean, if you're in a parking lot. I've actually, the other funny thing is I'm saying that, and I'm actually not making it up, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's why I was remember, pushing that one. Something like you would do.
No, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. But I walked into a garage once, and I saw this beautiful new Bentley. I mean, beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it had, you know what pool noodles are? Like the kids use for swimming, right? Yeah, they're like basically 2 or 3 inches in diameter and they're like 5 feet long. It had pool noodles all around it so that people who park next to it, when they open their doors, it wouldn't dent the car. So picture pool noodles with like ropes thrown over top so that they're all around the sides of it so it doesn't get any door dings.
Yeah, it's sort of like the bumpers on boats. Right? When they come in the dock, they put the bumpers over the side.
Exactly. It was the car version. Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, there might be a market for that. I wonder if it needs any standards, you know, spacing and width and sponginess and stuff like that.
Yeah. I want to see if he drove it that way though. Right. Or I want to see if he parked it in public places, if he put the pool noodles back out, or maybe he didn't drive it. That just seems
right. You can make them self-deploying, come out of the,
right.
You know, deploy out of the doors and just make little bumpers around it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
There's a standard there somewhere. We could write it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Definitely. Definitely.
That might be a whole website. Standards for things that nobody needs.
Stupidstandards.com.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that might be an idea. So if you want to work with us on stupidstandards.com, let us know. Adam's seen the poster child for it already. So
I think you're off.
But you know, that actually makes sense. But if they have a standard for it, then that takes it over the top. Yeah.
So the standard would be that. Well, actually, that's funny because remember the back in the 70s when all the cars had these weird accordion bumpers on the front and back? Mm-hmm. You know, these like big rubber bumpers, like there's accordions on the side, actually had shocks.
Yeah.
It's because out of nowhere, they made a standard that all cars had to have up to 5 mile an hour crash with, you know, very almost no damage.
Right.
So all the manufacturers were scrambling. How do you do this? You know, and they all everybody came up with this idea. OK, put shocks on there and these big, horrible bumpers. It took them years to figure out how to satisfy that standard and still be attractive. But that's exactly it. That would be like making a standard saying, and everybody's like, well, I guess we'll put pool noodles on it. That's pretty much what happened.
Yeah. It might be a business in this. Yeah.
Great.
So standards. Yeah. That'd be cool. Well, if you got other ideas for pool noodle protected Bentleys, things like that, let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And it's a page set up just to get your feedback and input and questions and ideas and things like that. And also, more to the point of what we talked about today, what's your favorite standard that doesn't make much sense, yet you're getting requests from customers in your market to do and make sure it happens? Yet it probably, the ones I'm looking for are the ones that are obviously, this makes no sense whatsoever, but it's in the contract, so we got to do it. Those kinds of stories just, I think we'll be fodder for many, many more discussions. So please join the conversation, ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. So thanks so much, Adam. Now I got this visual. It's sort of like an earworm, but a visual. I got to Google this.
You'll find, I'm sure you'll find pictures.
Okay. So thanks much, Adam. Talk to you later.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.